Okay, well, welcome everyone, and thanks for coming out this evening. This is actually the first guest presentation in conjunction with the theme this year, the theme of progress. My name is Ingrid Erberg, and I know many of you, but not everybody. I teach Scandinavian Studies here at Augustana. And as my students and many of you are aware, since the early 90s, Norway has played an important role as a facilitator in a number of peace and reconciliation processes in the world. In places such as Colombia, Guatemala, the Middle East, Somalia, Sri Lanka, and Afghanistan. And Afghanistan is a place that our guest this evening, Dr. Christian Hartvigsen, is, he knows it very well. He started his work there about 25 years ago now, I guess, so has been engaged there a long time. Before I introduce him, though, I would like to thank NORLA, which is Norwegian Literature Abroad, which has provided some generous funding for this event, as well as the Scandinavian Trade and Culture Society Endowment Fund. It is a pleasure to introduce Christian Hartvigsen this evening. He spent some time this afternoon with students in this room, and it was a very informative and engaging event. And before actually I get to the introduction, I should say you are going to field your own questions at the end, right? So I'm going to introduce you and then sit down and you can take over. Christian Hartvigsen is a Norwegian sociologist and researcher at PRIO, the Peace Research Institute of Oslo. It's an international research institute. So it isn't, as you told us this afternoon, it's not a Norwegian Peace Research Institute, but international. The overarching purpose of PRIO is to conduct research on the conditions for peaceful relations between states, groups, and people. The institute and its staff of experts contribute significant research in the form of publications, seminars, and public lectures on current global issues of conflict and peace. Hartvigsen began as a research fellow at PRIO in 1995, and after serving as deputy director from 2005 to 2008, he has been director since 2009. His PhD is in sociology from the University of Oslo, and he's also been a guest researcher at Georgetown University and the University of Chicago. Geographically, the focus of his research is Afghanistan and its neighbors, and thematically, his research addresses compelling issues of conflict and peace, including transnational mobilization and civil war, war-related migration and social networks, and peace building and peacemaking. He has published broadly, and he is a frequently used media commentator and lecturer. His annual speculation of who will win the Nobel Peace Prize are cited globally, including by BBC, CNN, The New York Times. This evening, he will be speaking on Norway's peace engagement, approaches, achievements, and dilemmas. So please join me in welcoming Christian.
Thanks a lot, Ingrid, and thanks a lot for the invitation to talk to you here tonight. It's great to be at Augustana, and I've already had a very interesting afternoon spending part of it with students. I've now just learned a little bit of the skiing history of Camrose, which I was entirely negligent about before coming here today. I've also learned interesting things about the Canadian political debate, many aspects of it, including the stories, the narratives of Canadian Afghans returned from Guantanamo. So it's been a stimulating afternoon already. I hope I can give something in return through my talk. I've been asked to talk about the Norwegian peace engagement, something I like to do, something I'm quite often asked about in my current position as a director of the Peace Research Institute Oslo. Many people, many ministries of foreign affairs of the world send delegation to Norway to try to find out what is the code for Norway's enormous success in this area. We can return to the issue of success. We can certainly discuss how successful many of the engagements have been, but the general perception is that this has been a fabulous success for Norway and for Norwegian foreign policy. Now, before I start saying more about that, I want to set the tone by displaying a little video, less than 3 minutes, from the web pages of the magazine Monocle. Monocle this summer ran a 10-page article on Norway's peace engagement. not all ministers of foreign affairs of the world get to be the main feature of the Monaco magazine. So this already tells you something about what Norway gets out of its peace engagement.
When did we stop talking? When did we stop listening? When did we start pretending to talk and pretending to listen just to show we'd given it a go? Diplomacy is messy, it's boring, it's tiring. But those who know what the alternative is know how important the messy, the boring, the tiring really is. Jaw-jaw, not war-war, remember? The Norwegians haven't forgotten. They are still prepared to sit through the endless meetings, the hours of detailed talks in foreign tongues, in far-off lands, the dry food and the humid air, the early breakfasts and the late dinners, food by one elbow, papers by the other. Negotiations that last for months, then fall apart. They sit with the Sudanese, they talk to the Taliban, and they're here in Havana, a neutral mediator in a neutral nation, as the Colombian government and the FARC guerrillas try to end the longest running conflict in the Western Hemisphere. It's a background role. They sit, they listen, they take notes, they nod, they sympathise, they occasionally make a suggestion. Then it's back in the cars, or back on the plane, and on to the next meeting. It's the sort of painstaking, patient-shattering, never-getting-any-credit work that really should be carried out by the United Nations. But instead, it's Norway, population 5 million, which has become the world's peacemaker. The reasons why are fairly straightforward. They want to make the world a better place. They're rather good at it, and it gives them influence. On this trip to Cuba and Colombia, they open an embassy, discuss a trade deal, sign a cooperation agreement. Sacrifices have to be made for peace processes to begin. Ending a war means talking to and compromising with people who don't share your values. To get the FARC round the table, Norway has to turn a blind eye to the EU's list of terrorist groups, of which FARC is a long-standing member. To get Cuba on board means having a proper diplomatic relationship with them and not refusing to engage because of their human rights record. This is what diplomacy looks like. Messy, boring, tiring, endless. But for the victims and the ordinary citizens, those who want justice and those who seek peace, it's the only option. And in the faded grandeur of Havana, in the seclusion of a semi-secret state, the Norwegians have their notebooks out and are ready to listen, for as long as it takes. For Monocle in Havana, I'm Steve Bloomfield.
I wonder if I'll sit. I actually plan to stand, but I feel that I'm towering over you then, so I think I'll sit down. The film makes a number of interesting points that we will come back to, but as I said initially, I think what it most prominently displays is exactly what sort of influence and what sort of branding effect it is that Norway gets out of its engagement in this area. No, I'm not going to argue that this is all about branding. It's about much more than that. I hope that in the course of the next minutes we can paint a little bit more of a nuanced picture. But it certainly is clear that this is something that has served Norway very well. Many people think that Norway has sort of been engaged in peacemaking for many decades, if not for centuries, and the narrative that often is being told about this in a Norwegian context also speaks to it as if this is a very, very long tradition. But I do think if you look at this empirically, the engagement we're talking about really has a history that is pretty exactly two decades old. The first claim to fame in this area by Norway was the Oslo peace process, the negotiations between Israel and the Palestinians that led to the Oslo Treaty in 1993, also rewarded by a Nobel Peace Prize. And which really, a process that really brought the limelight onto Norway. That was a process that, in many ways, came about by virtually by accident, was a Norwegian research institute, not my own, one called FAFO, F-A-F-O, an institute set up by the Norwegian Labour Union that spearheaded that process. One of its chief or one of its senior researchers was posted in Cairo. His wife was a senior diplomat there. He happened to strike a relationship with certain central actors and saw the opportunities and ran with them. And parenthetically, since we are in North America, it's worth pointing out that in doing that, the Norwegians actually also managed to keep the Americans in the dark. The Deputy Secretary of State at the time, Edward Gerian, who is now the director of the Baker Institute in Houston, visited us in Oslo just a couple of months ago, and we had the occasion to talk at length about this. And Ed Gerian told us about how he had, in one early morning meeting, been exposed to the question as to whether there was something going on in Oslo, because of course the Americans were actually running a process in Washington and thought they were doing the real thing, and then somebody had the sense that there was something going on with Norwegians. So they spent the next week exploring, turning every stone to try to find out whether there were anything to the rumors, and decided that there was not. Just later to find out that they were actually the ones that were sidelined. Now, that's not something you can do every time you conduct a peace process, of course. Norway has since been engaged in numerous peace processes, more than I think we can count, even if we all of us threw our energy into it, we wouldn't be able to establish the full list. The Norwegian Ministry of Foreign Affairs currently says that it's engaged in some 20 peace processes worldwide. I could probably identify about a dozen of them, but which ones the eight others are, I would not be able to identify. The approach that Norway takes is an approach that probably can most succinctly be summed up by the lack of one clear approach. Nonetheless, there is often talk about something called the Norwegian model. And every single diplomat at the Norwegian Ministry of Foreign Affairs that you talk to would say there is no such thing as a Norwegian model. Nonetheless, if you go to their web pages, at least their Norwegian language web pages, you would find 7 points summing up what the Norwegian model is about. And although I've already said that the chief characteristic of the Norwegian model is the lack of a model, I'm going to go through the model with you, because the 7 points in that model is actually a quite nice list of factors which gives us occasion to reflect upon how the Norwegians do this and what it is that they are doing and what the inherent dilemmas are. The first factor, and perhaps the most important single factor in the so-called Norwegian model, is a long-term willingness to assist. This long-term commitment has a number of roots. I think most importantly, it has its root in what I would call a broad domestic consensus that underpins the whole engagement. And we've just had a test to that consensus now with the change of government in Norway a few weeks back, when we have had the center-left alliance replaced by an alliance between the Conservatives and the Progress Party, the Progress Party being a party most commonly described as rightist populist, not a description they ascribe to themselves, I should add. But nonetheless, a party that has never been in power before, and a party that has been quite vocal in its criticism of the way in which Norway spends much of its capital and diplomatic energy on pursuing various peacemaking adventures around the world. Now, once in office, they are part of a government that seem pretty determined to continue the policy as before. There are very strong indications from the government that the policy will remain pretty much unchanged. Perhaps some minor adjustments, but nothing dramatic. We may see more dramatic changes in areas such as development policy, but the peacemaking policy, the trademark of Norway's foreign policy, is very unlikely to change much. Of course, this domestic consensus,
across political parties is also reflected in a broader constituency. And I'm not going to try to tell you that everybody in Norwegian society is deeply committed to Norway's peacemaking engagement. But it certainly does go on, go beyond a little elite consisting of policymakers, politicians, and perhaps even others who make a living from dealing with issues of peace and war, including myself. There is a broader engagement that has to do with, in part, a long missionary tradition, with organizations and the types of engagement that has not only been limited to Norway, but that expresses itself in strong transnational networks, and lots of people who have actually been working abroad, developed contacts abroad, have a type of exposure and a type of insight that breeds a certain type of commitment. But not only the missionary movement, also other types of NGOs, labor unions, and so forth have been deeply engaged in various types of international solidary work, if you want. So there is a broader constituency. Now, this long-term willingness to assist also expresses itself in something that Norway takes great pride in, and that we heard problematized in the little video that we just displayed, namely a willingness to talk to all parties. And of course, the willingness to talk to all parties stems also from an ability to talk to all parties. And here, one of Norway's major comparative advantages is the fact that Norway is not a member of the EU and therefore does not have to abide by EU regulations. And again, it's interesting to note that the Progress Party, now a member of government, 3 days before before the last elections, sent out a press release in which they declared that were they to enter government, then they would certainly make sure that the government immediately signed on to the EU's terror list and stopped talking to all the bad guys of the world. Now, once they are in government, nobody has heard anything of that. So I don't think that's very likely to materialize. But this long-term willingness to assist, now to the long-term willingness to talk to all parties and the dilemmas that comes from it, is certainly something we should return to. The second factor is resources to assist. That, of course, has to do with money. Norway is a fairly well-endowed nation, now a nation with a sovereign wealth fund that corresponds to well over 4 annual state budgets. I don't think there's any other country in the world that can compare itself with that. But I don't think, in fact, the financial muscle is the most important. I think what is most important is an extremely unbureaucratic approach to decision-making and disbursement in this area. That means that actually if somebody who is a known entity, for example, in the Norwegian NGO community, say somebody who is leading a section in one of the Norwegian main NGOs and who has good contacts with one or several of the parties in Sudan, gets a brilliant idea as to how to get entry into something that can potentially, in a shorter or longer term perspective, contribute to the peace process in Sudan, and calls up the Minister of Foreign Affairs, either somebody higher up in the bureaucracy or somebody in a political position, and makes a suggestion, then the decision can be made, and if money are necessary, money can be dispersed within the next 24 hours. I've worked with Canadian bureaucracies. I'm pretty certain that that's not the case. Talk to diplomats from many ministries around the world and discuss this with them, and they are absolutely amazed that it is possible, and they wish that they would be able to do the same. So that very flexibility there in acting quickly, no red tape, which is absolutely not only about money, but also about money, is very important, I think. And perhaps one of the few factors that really sets the Norwegian approach apart from anybody else's approach. The third factor is cooperation with Norwegian NGOs. And certainly in Norway, and I've already indicated this, there is a quite thorough trust that characterizes relationships between the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, various NGOs that operate internationally, and for that matter, research institutions that operate internationally. But here, on this particular factor, there's been a very interesting change in the Norwegian peace engagement if we look at it in a 20-year perspective. If we look back to the 1990s, most of Norway's peace processes were actually initiated by actors in civil society and even pulled through to a large extent by actors in civil society. The three most prominent peace processes Norway was engaged in the 1990s would be the Israeli-Palestinian process, which we already talked about.
That's called the Oslo Accord?
What?
The Oslo Accord?
Yeah, the Oslo Accord. Then the Guatemala Peace Treaty, which was concluded in 1996, and the Mali Peace Treaty, which was concluded in the same year. Both of the two latter treaties were initiated by key individuals in one particular NGO, the Norwegian Church Aid, who had worked for a long time in the respective countries, primarily in development or humanitarian aid, developed extensive contacts in various camps, had the trust of more than one of the parties, and played a very, 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 very central role in pulling the whole agreement through. Around the turn of the millennium, we see a major professionalization of the Norwegian efforts. We see the Minister of Foreign Affairs building up a section on peace and reconciliation, not very heavily staffed, currently at about 17 members of staff. But nonetheless, that decision to build that particular section represents an effort by the ministry to pull the initiative in from the NGO community and certainly the implementation in from civil society into the professional apparatus. The interaction with civil society is still there and runs very deep. But more often than not, the initiative now comes from people within the bureaucracy rather than people in civil society. Fourth factor, experience. Although anybody would hasten to add that every conflict is unique and there are limitations to how much knowledge you can draw from one to the next conflict you are engaged in. Part of the motivation for establishing the very section in the ministry that I just referred to was exactly to systematize knowledge. Fifth factor, good relationships to key international actors. One key international actor is a neighboring country to the country we currently are in, the US, which of course to Norway is the central ally and the main security guarantor, but also a country that Norway often draws upon and keeps informed, despite what I just said about the Oslo Peace Treaty, informs when it is engaged in various peace processes. But also other actors in the European Union, Russia, India, whatever. And of course also Norway's role and position within multilateral contexts as a major contributor to the UN in particular. And the sixth factor that is listed in this so-called Norwegian model, which isn't a model, is no colonial past. And that's really used as a proxy for Norway's lack of a self-interest in the very processes it is engaged in. That's also something which I'll return to in a minute. Norway takes great pride, though, in never having been a colonial power. Partly, of course, as those of you who know Scandinavian history well, saved by the very fact that we were not an independent country at the time that colonialism was on its height. So we're partly faking history there, but nonetheless, it works. The narrative works. And Norway has been fairly strong in insisting on not having a particular self-interest driving its peace engagements. The seventh and final factor is that Norway is a peace facilitator, not a peace mediator. And that may sound like a play on words, but it's more than that. What Norway means by saying that is that Norway does not take responsibility for the resolution of the conflict, for the positions that are expressed around the table, and for the compromises that are hammered out. You'd always hear Norwegian diplomats say, the conflict belongs to the parties, the process belongs to the parties. All we do is to set up the tables, to convey messages. Occasionally, the Monocle journalist insisted, Norway also may make a proposition, but only occasionally. But the point here is that Norway really insists on the responsibility being with the parties. Now, that, of course, is also an argument that allows Norway to say, even when we talk to the bad guys, we are not responsible for what the bad guys say or what the bad guys have done in their checkered pasts. But that only brings you so far, because I do think it is quite clear that once you set up a negotiation table and you invite parties to that table as a recognized international actor, even a state such as Norway, you do bestow a certain legitimacy upon these actors. If you take an extreme example, let's say that it was an idea to engage the central leadership of Al-Qaeda in some sort of a peace process, and Norway, or for that matter anybody else who has a reputation in this area, sits down and invites Al-Qaeda to sit at one side of the negotiation table, it is clear that that does something with the way in which Al-Qaeda is perceived, or perhaps in that particular example, something with the way in which the negotiator is perceived rather than Al-Qaeda itself. I'm just using that as an extreme example to drive the point home. So I think Norway may be doing it a little bit, trying to make it a little bit too easy for itself with this particular argument. Now, I've already said that there is considerable consensus about Norway's peace engagement. That doesn't mean there aren't different types of criticism that emerge also within the Norwegian debate. I would say that that critical debate about the peace engagement, and I'm going to lay out three different types of argument that I would say are the most frequent ones heard in Norway. I would say that that is mainly an argument that emerges within what I would here refer to as the foreign policy elite. It's mainly coming from critiques within academia in particular. And the first argument that we often hear is that Norway's peace engagement does not help Norway. This, of course, resonates with what I already said about Norway's self-interest, Norway's claim not to have a self-interest in this area. And here, again, there's been a quite interesting transformation during the past government, the Labour government. The centre-left government that just left office. When they took office in 2005, there was a very, very clear insistence, both from that government and from the preceding government, that Norway's peace engagement was only about Norway's responsibility to contribute to a better world. No self-interest whatsoever. Then there was an emerging criticism, not the least from academic circles, that the peace engagement does nothing to help Norway strengthen its position in the world or pursue its own interests. And the response to that has been to try to bridge that contradiction between self-interest and idealism. So increasingly the argument has been made that although Norway does this for the greater good, it also does contribute to Norway's self-interest. An example of that would be whereas a Norwegian prime minister or foreign minister, a Norwegian prime minister would be very hard put to get an appointment at the White House to discuss salmon export or oil trade. What could make the Norwegian Prime Minister very interesting at the White House would be Norway's role in the Middle East. And of course, the argument then goes, once you are there to discuss the Middle East, you may also draw in a couple of arguments that has to do with salmon and with oil and other issues that are more directly related to Norway's narrower self-interests. So it's been interesting to see, and it's also been interesting to see the few indications we have gotten from the government that took office a few weeks back, which in fact points toward more of a purification of the old idealistic motivation. That would come as a surprise to those of you who follow Norwegian politics, but I said to the extent we had had any indications, and there's been a few. There is a rebuttal of the attempt to harmonize self-interest with idealism. And if you want my opinion about this, I think it's in one sense very healthy to admit that Norway also has self-interests. It's obvious for everybody, of course, that there are self-interests in this. But it is problematic once you start to argue that there is full harmony between the self-interest and the idealism, because that is not evidently the case. And if Norway's peace engagement were going to be in large part motivated by where it is that Norway could derive a profit, whether that profit be financial or something else, for example, if you would perceive that Norway enters into a particular mediating role in Libya because it sees great potential in its oil reserves, then I think Norway has a deep problem. Then I think much of the reputation that Norway has, much of the trust that is often placed in Norway as a mediator, is gone. So it's quite tricky. The second type of criticism that we also often hear is that Norway does not have what it takes. And you may ask, why would a small country such as Norway, with 5 million inhabitants, placed at the outer northern rim of Europe, be playing such a prominent role? How can it be able to play such a prominent role? And of course, the empiric speaks against that argument, because Norway has actually played that role quite dominantly over the past 20 years. But as we speak, we're seeing major transformations of the global geopolitical order, with what used to be a unilateral world in which the US was the dominant actor militarily, economically, and otherwise. We are seeing a move toward something else. Now, perhaps it's a little premature to say whether that something else is a multipolar world or a non-polar world, but it certainly is a world which is very different. And if it is a multipolar world, it's not so easy to see that the space for actors such as Norway would be similar to what it has been over the past couple of decades. Now, of course, this is not something that Norway is totally ignorant of, so it's trying to take certain measures to adapt to the changing world order, and will also be returning to that. The third type of criticism, which is probably the most fundamental one, the most serious one, is that it does not help peace. Norway's engagement does not help peace. There is a mild version of this, and there is a stronger version of this. And the mild version is that Norway's peace engagement, although it may marginally be contributing to foster peace where there has been unrest before, at the same time is undermining basic human rights, undermining democratic values. And of course, if you legitimize problematic actors, as I've already talked about several times in my talk so far, it's easy to see how that could be part of the cost. But there is also a far more dramatic version of this argument, which is that Norway's peace engagement, the type of peace engagement that Norway is engaged in, prevents a sustainable resolution of conflicts. That could be in the form of simply prolonging conflicts that are ripe for resolution through military means, through pure use of force, or it could be through permitting the actors in conflict to use the cover of a peace process to equip themselves for an end game. I think in hindsight, if you look at the peace process in Sri Lanka, for example, it's quite clear that in the latter stages of that conflict, Norway unknowingly contributed to create the image of a mediation process that the government used to equip itself for an end game. So all of these are quite serious criticisms. whether we think any of them have full merit is, of course, a different question. So what are...
Where does criticism from within or from without?
Excuse me?
Where does the criticism come from within Norway? From
this, is mainly from a debate within the foreign policy elite in Norway. I don't see a similarly systematic and expressed critique from voices outside Norway. I'm not saying there aren't critical voices. There certainly are. But it seems to me that much of that criticism is less focused. The three types of arguments I just outlined are arguments that are not widely shared, but are consistently pursued by certain voices in the Norwegian debate. And I could easily reference each of these three positions with quite influential thinkers within Norwegian academia in particular. Partly also within the Norwegian NGO sector, but mainly within academia. Achievements, of course, are in this area notoriously difficult to demonstrate. And I think Norway, again, is very aware of that. If we look at what the statistics tell us, we can look at the conflicts that the world has lived with over the past 30 years. And if you count them, and there are people who count conflicts, we have quite a few people at PRIO who actually count conflicts. And if you want to count something, you have to agree on what that something is. So for these purposes, a conflict is a disagreement between a government and somebody else that has cost more than 25 lives within a given calendar year. And if we count it that way, from 1982 to 2012, the world saw 151 conflicts altogether. That's helpful because that gives us a population that's large enough to start to say a little bit about patterns. Shouldn't exaggerate the statistical significance, but still, it's a considerable population. And out of these 151 conflicts, 28% have found a negotiated end. So a little bit more than one quarter of these conflicts can be said to have been solved exclusively through a negotiated end. A negotiation process. Almost one-fourth would be conflicts that are still ongoing, so we can exclude them for the present. Almost one-fourth are conflicts that have been resolved through a military victory. But then there is a fourth where it's much more unclear. It's not an outright military victory. It's not clear that it has... been resolved through a peace process. Very often the conflict has petered out. Negotiations may be part of that. Negotiations, mediation may have contributed to limit the consequences of conflict. They may have brought ideas onto the table that somehow have shaped an implicit agreement between the parties that has contributed to end the conflict. But to establish exactly what the contribution of mediation has been in contexts such as this is very, very difficult. And it is difficult in part because it is difficult to establish what a particular actor's role is. Norway, of course, is not the only actor that tries to deal with the conflicts we are talking about. Very often it's one amongst many that act. Sometimes there are many that act in their own capacity. Sometimes there is more of a collective effort. I think increasingly we see that there are more and more collective efforts. The example of the current peace process in Colombia, where Norway has teamed up with Cuba, with Venezuela and Chile in quite prominent supporting positions, is illustrative of much more innovative approaches to build various types of coalitions, not only in the support of peace process, but in fact to be the driving force in various peace processes. But again, to say who and who it was that contributed significantly to bring about a particular peace process in a particular way is notoriously difficult. And then, of course, it is it is also very, very difficult to pre-plan peace process. We are in the area of foreign policy, and even in my own area in research, increasingly exposed to a sort of management by objectives regime in which before you invest in anything, are supposed to come up with the ultimate objective, and preferably a hierarchy of sub-objectives and activities that will contribute to that ultimate objective. Now, if your objective is to try to bring about peace between the Israelis and the Palestinians, that may sound fine and dandy, but to lay out the hierarchy of sub-objectives and activities that would bring you there is probably a bit more problematic. But to say it differently, and I'm going to paraphrase now a Norwegian diplomat that I was with in Rio a few days ago when we had a seminar hosted by the Norwegian and the Brazilian Ministries of Foreign Affairs on peace and reconciliation. And he, being well aware of the fact that the Brazilians, who currently have very tall ambitions in this area, do tend to think that it's possible to sit back in Brasilia and handpick two or three or four conflicts where they think Brazil really can make a difference, then engage heavily in those three and four conflicts and be successful in all, or at least most of them, used the following metaphor. He said, you know, in Norway we like to go hunting. And when we go hunting, we often do it in the autumn, it's often raining, we go uphill, we go downhill, we get wet, we walk for 12 hours, and sometimes we don't even see a single grouse. Sometimes we do meet a grouse, and then there is action, there is shooting, it takes 2 minutes, and then there's another 12 hours of walking in the dark. And it's no coincidence, of course, that the hunting metaphor is used by a Norwegian diplomat. But I do think it tells you something not only about the difficulties of demonstrating success in this area, but it also tells you something about one of the success factors of Norway. Because although I've already argued that Norway's engagement as a peacemaker only dates 20 years back, much of what has been achieved in those 20 years has its roots many decades before that. So Norway's role in the Sudan, for example, is a role that has been based in Norway's comprehensive development and humanitarian engagements in Sudan that dates back at least to the early 1960s, where a number of Norwegian aid workers have been deeply engaged. Some of them were later pulled into the Norwegian Ministry of Foreign Affairs to play key roles in the peace process, have been engaged, developed networks, developed understanding of the conflict, and that has really been the basis for the Norwegian role. And I could use a number of examples like that, but I'll leave it with the Sudan example. I think ultimately many of these challenges about demonstrating success are difficult to address satisfactorily. I think what Norway has increasingly equipped itself with is sort of an Hippocratic oath, where the ultimate standard is to make sure that one does not do harm, and preferably that one does more good than harm. But I think one is fully cognizant, increasingly cognizant, of the limitations that there is to Norway's control over any of the processes in which it is engaging, and one is increasingly cognizant of the uncertainties. And I think that has inserted a very healthy dosage of soberness into the Norwegian debate about this, and certainly a healthy dosage of soberness into the way in which Norwegian diplomats and politicians talk about it. So whereas in the 1990s you would see quite a bit of boasting by Norwegian representatives about Norway's peacemaking, the approach now is much more a modest one. So before we round off, let's look a little bit at a few challenges ahead. I'll limit it to three. And there certainly are challenges. And I think the first one, which begs quite significant challenges to Norway as a small power with, after all, limited resources, is what we have seen over the past decade, namely a move towards more and more complex operations. I think the preferred Canadian term is 3D, diplomacy, defense, and development going hand in hand. I think there are about a dozen similar terms which are preferred by different actors, but they all boil down to the same thing, which is that in order to really make a difference bringing about peace, one needs to have the capacity to synchronize different capacities. And it's quite obvious that while Norway may be able, with relatively little manpower, to play a significant role in peacemaking, in the diplomatic part of this equation, its ability to be a similarly influential actor in the development area, or even more critically in the defense area, is limited. So that is a challenge to Norway, but it is a challenge that Norway tries to meet by looking for various ways in which to coordinate closely with other actors and become part of multi-actor efforts. The second challenge, the second of the challenges I would dwell with here, rather, is that there is increasing competition. And I commented on this initially by alerting you to the many people knocking my institute's door to try to crack the code, to try to find out what the secret behind Norway's peace engagement is. Needless to say, since you heard most of what I have to say, I don't have that key. So many of them probably leave PRIO a little bit disappointed. But it is remarkable to see how many countries in the world over the past few years have developed huge ambitions in this area. Many of them are very inspired by the role that Norway has deployed. We heard the journalist in the Monocle video here say that Norway is being the world's peacemaker, doing the work that actually the UN should be the one to be doing. I think that's probably a slight exaggeration, to say the least, but nonetheless, tells you something about the reputational impact that comes out of this. Norway's response again to this is to less and less be going the road alone. We talked about the Colombia example, the peace process there. One example that Norwegian diplomats would very often use is the efforts that were made in Kenya after the electoral violence in 2008, when Norway quietly, alongside other actors, deployed the resources, both monetary resources and analytical resources, to set up Kofi Annan with a team and actually go in and talk to the parties, and through that probably contributing quite significantly to quell violence that could otherwise have proved explosive. So in that case, not only a collective effort, but also an effort for which no particular actor was credited even in its aftermath. And then the final challenge is a challenge that I've been touching upon repeatedly, which is the ways in which the global patterns of power are changing. And I think that is a quite deep challenge to Norway. We often talk about something that we call the international community. I don't think such a thing exists. But there is, nonetheless, an extent to which there has been sort of a Western-based consensus about what it is that constitutes peace and security in the world, what are the legitimate means by which to pursue it. And Norway has, in many ways, alongside Canada, at least until a few years back, been at the very center of that consensus, or perhaps at the very forefront of that consensus. Now, what we see with the emergence of new powers that claim a place on the world scene, and thinking particularly about countries such as China, India, Russia for that matter, Turkey, it could be mentioned, we see new actors that not only challenge the U.S. hegemony in terms of its sheer realist economic and military power in the world, But more importantly, we are seeing new actors that think very differently about the very normative orientations that should guide our perceptions of peace and security. And the a former Norwegian politician who has actually returned to government a few weeks back, Vidar Helgesen, he was the deputy minister of foreign affairs in the Norwegian government from 2001 to 2005, and also acted as the chief negotiator in Sri Lanka. After the end game in Sri Lanka in 2008, when the government launched an outright onslaught on the Tamil Tigers, issued a very interesting little reflection in an email that at first was only circulated to friends and acquaintances, but later became the subject of debate in Norwegian media. And his reflection was the following. The main reason that the government in Colombo was able to do what it did was that the world had changed. So whereas earlier it would have been very difficult for the Sri Lankan government to arm itself and to launch an outright onslaught on the Tamil Tigers in serious violation of this international consensus that I've already talked about, in the new world there are a number of other competing powers with a whole different set of normative orientations that finds it absolutely opportune to encourage and support the Sri Lankan government in doing exactly that. And without that global change and without those new centers with alternative normative orientations, the end game that we saw in Sri Lanka would have been unthinkable. I think that's food for thought. And I think we are often, when we talk about the transformations in the global geopolitical order, overestimating the importance of competing economic and military power and underestimating the importance of possibly contending normative systems. We see it now very clearly in Syria with the impasse in the UN Security Council, where many have wondered what it is in the world that drives Russia's reluctance to condone some sort of a resolution that at least can foster some international agreement on how to approach, or at least to have an opinion about what goes on in Syria. And many have thought that that has to do with the narrow self-interest, such as Russian bases on the Mediterranean. But increasingly it's becoming clear that there is a very deep principled position by Russia, which has to do with a totally different view of the importance of state sovereignty, in serious violation of the Canadian-inspired concept responsibility to protect, which of course boils down the importance of state sovereignty. That is what has driven the Russian position on Syria, partly as a response to what happened in Libya, but more importantly as a principled position which Russia actually has pursued quite successfully. And I think we're seeing the results of that as we speak, where Russia is and Russia's position is coming full circle with the recent turnaround regarding chemical weapons, and in fact that possibly opening up for a new round of political approaches to Syria, in which Assad, or at least representatives of the Assad regime, may end up as being seen as legitimate negotiation partners in a political process. So with that, I'll end the monologue and look forward to the dialogue. And Ingrid asked me to share, and obviously I won't know too many names around the table, so I will be rude and point a finger to whoever wants to be first, second, and third. Forgive me for that. How much time do we have, Ingrid?
Oh, we have plenty of time.
All night.
Yeah, so, 20 minutes or whatever. We have plenty of time.
Little video says the Norwegians will listen forever.
Exactly.
I was wondering, in part, what role Norwegian business or corporate interests would play in Norway's ability to be a peace facilitator. Mm. And I think about this in perhaps in comparison or contrast to Canada right now.
Mm.
For example, Canadian mining interests or banking interests around the world are probably more of an impediment to Canada being able to play that sort of role. So I was wondering how that works in Norway.
The active role of business, of Norwegian business in this area has been very, very limited. But of course, that doesn't mean that business doesn't play a role. And of course, Norway, being the state that it is itself a major business actor. Companies like Statoil are majority owned by the state. Norway is operating the world's largest sovereign wealth fund. No detail in the global investment landscape. So even if unwillingly Norway's economic interest does play a role, and I think more negatively than positively at the moment, there's been very little effort to harness business actors for this agenda. But of course, the very weight of Norwegian economic engagements abroad does bring attention to the potential that Norway is pursuing what it pursues for self-interest. It's interesting to compare that with some of the emerging, some of the new kids on the block. Brazil, for example, is very open about how it wants to use its business actors, its business presence in a number of countries to open up new avenues for peace engagement. Turkey is a country that's done so quite successfully, in Africa in particular. So we see new models in which business actors play a very different role, with, of course, all the ambiguities that follows from that.
So, Christian, I think you for really engaging, interesting overview. And I wanted to come back to one of the critiques that you said, largely coming from academic circles, which of course makes it an excellent critique to begin with. But now I want to push this a little bit, this question that engagement doesn't help peace, or in fact that it actually either lengthens a conflict. And I'm curious about Kenya, because I suspect Kenya is most often brought out as one of these success stories, one of the key achievements. But within that academic critique, do people look at Kenya and say, what actually happened was that there was a conflict that sort of came to the public fore, and because of the non-intervention, it has essentially gone underground, so that it is, hasn't really been resolved, but more or less suppressed? Would that be a kind of critique, and then what would be your response to that?
I think my response to that has to be that I don't know Kenya enough to really judge. But if the process that you lay out is one that you can empirically justify, I think that would be an eminent example of that critique. And I think there are always risks that you may be doing that, and it's, you know, what your example also brings out is that it's very, very difficult to be certain.
So it's dangerous. Peace engagement.
Well, you know, this is not an innocent engagement. This is an engagement fraught with dilemmas, and that's why I'm also emphasizing quite strongly that the attempt to dissolve oneself from responsibility for what one is contributing to is ultimately unsustainable. There is a very serious responsibility that follows with taking on these roles.
Christian, I have a question regarding the players. You mentioned Turkey and Brazil.
Yeah.
Who do you see as other players around the world that you would see as competition? And maybe not competition, you can also, yes, be helpers for some of this peace.
Well, of course, to take the last point first, Norway's response to this is to try to build alliances with these new actors, the new actors that one thinks are most likely to succeed. So when I was asked by the Norwegian Minister of Foreign Affairs to contribute to a seminar in Brasilia and another one in Rio a few days back, that's no coincidence, of course. That's part of exactly Norway's attempt to build new relationships. And when it builds those new relationships, one doesn't do it only government to government or ministry to ministry. One also tries to do it at an academic level, at the civil society level. And that's, again, typical of the Norwegian approach, to think in multi-layers or multiple tracks, if you want. Who are the actors that seems most likely to emerge as dominant ones? Turkey is one that probably already can claim a certain success, not the least in branding itself as a serious actor in this area. They're throwing enormous resources into it, currently building a new Turkish embassy building adjacent to the UN building in New York that will not be quite as tall as the UN building, but nonetheless will be quite a landmark, has initiated a process to build what they have called a mediation retreat in the vicinity of Istanbul, something that has taken different shapes during 2-3 years of negotiation and is now probably going to be much more of a capacity building center than the sort of mediation center in which parties are brought together that the Turks envisaged to begin with. So the Turks are rather well positioned, despite their own unresolved conflicts, both with the Kurds and with and in Cyprus. Quite serious impediments, I would say. We work in Cyprus, so we know something about that. But there are a number of countries. Spain, for example, has been quite ambitious. Belgium, of course, the EU itself is trying to equip itself with a foreign policy, and in the current talks with Iran over the nuclear issue are playing a quite prominent role. In other parts of the world, I mean, I've already mentioned Brazil, of course, but you know, you see it emerging from also countries that you would not necessarily have expected it from. It's clear that when Cuba, for example, partners with Norway in driving the Colombian peace process, it's not only because Norway needs a partner, it's also because Cuba actually wants to play a role in this area. So I think we've gone from a situation where there was a handful of countries with an interest in filling this role to a situation where there are tens, if not, you know, in the range of 100 countries that actually have some ambition to play a role in this area. So it's a very, very different landscape in that sense. Thank you, and then,
I would really be interested in your reflections on these new players and how they think differently about peace and security.
Mm.
I spent a little time in Turkey recently,
right,
and I was very struck by how at many levels in government and in the educational establishment, they're all speaking about Turkey as being a major player on the cusp of a new civilization.
Mm.
And while the content of that was a little hard to discern, there certainly was a sense, I mean, they were certainly on their uppers, and they're going somewhere. Mm. So Turkey interests me particularly, yeah. I suppose, because of my little relationship there. So if you think about Turkey and your suggestion that these new players really think differently than the West in their consensus about what constitutes peacemaking, what constitutes security, can you just say a little bit about how that is seen, perhaps, in one or two of them?
Well, you know, I think you already gave a description of Turkish thinking without necessarily being crystal clear about exactly what it is, and I think it's difficult to be crystal clear. And I haven't really studied sufficiently the positions of the different actors to lay out and typologize how they are similar and how they are different. But I do think that some of the very fundamental values in this old, and I think it is about to be outdated, or overrun at the very least, international consensus, are being systematically challenged by several of these actors. And I used the example of Syria and the Russian position to illustrate that. But of course, the fact that Russia has been challenging Western powers over their position on Syria is not a uniquely Russian position. It's a position that has been very clearly in the interest of China. And if Russia hadn't done it, probably China would have had to do it. Now, it serves China very well that Russia is doing it, and Russia is doing it successfully because they don't want need to tarnish themselves. You know, when it comes to China, Norway has faced this in a very direct manner with after the Nobel Peace Prize in 2010 was issued to Li Xiaobo, the Norwegian government has basically been boycotted by China. There hasn't been any political meeting between politicians on the two sides since that happened, despite Norway's insistence on the Nobel Committee being entirely independent, which is by and large is. And there is no doubt, at the very least, that that decision was an entirely independent one, and probably was even a decision that the Norwegian government would absolutely not have wanted, should it have been asked. And it did try to, we know that, it did try in different ways to convey that message, but that the Nobel Committee was unreceptive and nonetheless went along with it. But, you know, the Chinese, seeing this entirely as a domestic matter and as undue interference, and then also choosing not to accept the Norwegian argument that these are done by forces over which the Norwegian government has no control, displays an entirely different logic. Yeah. It's a huge topic, and it's a very interesting topic. On Turkey in particular, we have a report out on the PRIO web pages on how Turkish foreign policy is seen in the various regions surrounding Turkey, and we actually done a round of consultations with meetings in the Middle East, in the Balkans, and in the Caucasus, to look at how policymakers and civil society representatives in the surrounding areas look at Turkey's new ambitions.
Yeah, and whether they see it as the old ambition, a new look.
Well, you know, we have post-Ottoman in the title of that report, but that may indicate something.
But your central point here is really valuable to hear. I really appreciate you raising it. It challenges us to be alert to how these new players are perceived, and to be a little more alert to how we have just assumed that consensus is there.
Exactly.
That's very interesting. Thank you.
Please. No, you know, sorry.
Okay.
All right, then you're next.
I spent a little bit of time in Turkey, and I did note there politically that they were also investing heavily in militaristic power. They've got quite a strong growth in mobile arms. They're moving, so I hear what you're saying about the good thing, but I'm concerned about the other side of it. But apart from that, you talk about the Norwegian model, and we had a pretty good model under Lester B. Pearson at a time, you know, when I was a little kid, and we've stood up the map a lot. Does the Norwegian model change a lot every time you have a national election or federal election? Is it based a little bit on the leader's interests and the political party's interests? Does the model swing left or right based on who's in political power, or is it a pretty stable model? Because ours is not. We don't have one right now, but if we did, it would be stable.
Yeah, no, part of the point I tried to make earlier was that there is great stability in the Norwegian, and that may have been before you came in the door, actually, but there is great stability in the Norwegian model, and we've, in a sense, put that to the test now with the recent change of government, where for the first time you got the Progress Party into government so far, an untested entity in political power, and although they don't get into the central positions in foreign policy, the conservative, their alliance partner, takes those positions. It is clear that the peace engagement policy will be continued pretty much unchanged. You know, there will be nuances, and there will be nuances in the justification, and there may be a little different emphasis in who one works with. The portfolio may change slightly, but the signals are very, very clear that there is a commitment to continue this policy and to continue the present engagements. And that, my argument was that that very ability to be consistent over time is a primary quality of Norway's engagement. And of course, breeds the trust of the parties as well.
Sure would help in Canada, the US, but it seems stability.
Please.
My question follows up from what David was asking. But I profess great ignorance about international relations, politics, all of these things. And what you're describing as an alternative model or understanding of what constitutes peace doesn't strike me as peace at all. Russia is not advocating for peace in Syria in any way that I can recognize as an understanding of what peace would mean. Russia is advocating for protecting, and here's where I may be completely ignorant and you can help me be more sophisticated in my thinking. It seems to me that what Russia is advocating is the right to maintain its sovereignty over places it would like to be sovereign. And it doesn't want to give up any possibility. It doesn't want to take a position that other countries in the world would then take against it. Mm. And the same could be said of China. The same could be said of many other countries, possibly Turkey, that are, I don't see this as a model of peace. So I'm kind of confused about how it is an alternate model. Where's the peace?
Let's turn to a different concept to respond to that, the concept of security, which many people would see as the mirror image. Security conventionally has, you know, in international relations, security has really been the security of states. So states are the unit of analysis. Security is about the ability of states to protect its coherence, its external borders. Now, with the debate that emerged in the 1990s, noticeably only after the end of the Cold War, about human security, very much driven by Canada. Canada was the most important actor in driving that debate. The referent object of the security debate changed from the state to the individual. So suddenly security is about something entirely different. It's about the individual. And through changing the focus from the state to the individual, you also start to talk about security in a much more comprehensive manner. So it's not anymore only about physical security. It's about food security. It's about health. It's about the right to a rich life, ultimately. So it's a very different conception. And through that conception, you actually open up the avenue to humanitarian interventions. So then suddenly, the international community has not only the right to intervene to protect a population against a repressive state, in fact, it has the responsibility to intervene to do that. In Brazil now, I was exposed to a concept I was unfamiliar with before, which is a concept launched by the Brazilian government, quite elegantly, sophisticated, I'd say, which is responsibility while protecting. So rather than raising a direct counter-argument to responsibility to protect, they are pointing to the fact that if you believe that you have the right to intervene to protect somebody against their government, then there are certain responsibilities that comes with that that are quite difficult to live up to. So I thought that was an elegant move. But the point, of course, is also, if you see this from the perspective of Russia, for example, the intervention in Libya a couple of years ago was an intervention, in their perspective, an intervention that was not first and foremost motivated by idealism, by a deep wish to save the Libyan people from a repressive Gaddafi. No, it was an intervention that was motivated by much narrower self-interest. So in their perspective, the very reorientation of what security is about is something that is used instrumentally to allow certain types of actions that they would want to pursue. And there, of course, the problem comes in, and therefore, I think also we need to understand the very firm Russian resolve in opposing a similar development related to Syria.
Even though Syria is less obviously a mercenary goal.
Yes. Yes. And even though the U.S. wouldn't want to intervene in Syria anyhow.
No.
So, you know, what would have come out of a resolution in the Security Council is something, probably something much less dramatic than the intervention we saw in Libya. But nonetheless, Russia used the occasion to make their point, and they are quite successful in making it.
So I betray myself as someone well-educated by liberal communities.
That, no, that but you know.
I don't apologize for that, but that would be my understanding.
I don't think you should. I don't think you should.
And security. And it's good to hear that there are alternate, even if I don't like them.
Please.
How do you see the involvement of this new agent, such as Brazil, in the peacemaking process when there are so many unresolved conflicts inside the country itself? Regarding racial minorities and indigenous people in Brazil, which is a huge thing.
Well, the same could be said for Turkey or Russia or China or many of the other countries that we have mentioned. You know, I'm not convinced that unresolved conflicts domestically should necessarily exclude a particular country from playing a role internationally. I don't think that is the case. But of course, there is a certain resonance, and the most direct resonance is one that I find it very difficult to really get my head around, but that is the way in which a particular country with ambitions in this area deals with its own immigrant communities. Given the fact that we more and more clearly see that immigrant communities, through their diasporic engagements in the areas that they stem from, play a major political role both in the country where they currently reside and in the country where they stem from, which they may continue to play prominent political roles. The current Prime Minister of Somalia is Norwegian. So it's not only Somali terrorists occupying shopping malls in Kenya that are Norwegian citizens. It's also key political actors that Norway then encounter when they engage in the Somali conflict as political actors. And then, of course, the way in which Norway has dealt with immigration and integration issues starts to play a direct role in how it is that it can approach that abroad. So there, I think it's easier for me to see how conflicts at home have a direct impact on the roles one can play abroad. But from there to whether traditional conflicts at home with over other issues with more long-standing population groups should prevent anybody from engage, I think that is that's a stretch to me. I see Ingrid starting to look at the watch.
I have a really itchy question.
Okay, maybe take one more question. Just to say that because of the size of this group and there are lots of refreshments, we can continue the discussion over that, but why don't you have the last?
The elephant in the telephone booth is China. Have you worked with China much?
Not myself, no.
Because do you see where they might change or get involved soon in this whole international peace thing? Because we seem like we don't even see their foreign policy most times. They just seem to let U.S. trying to pretend as a superpower, while China is a superpower. What do you see China's role going forward? Is there power?
No, China is very, very interesting because, of course, China is already about to supersede the U.S. in terms of its economic influence in the world. Look at Africa, where China is such a prominent actor over virtually all parts of the continent. And China is interesting because it's quite consistently been arguing that it does not want to play a political role, which includes the peacemaking role that we're talking about here. Not only that, that's only a little part of it, but it wants to be an economic actor. It wants to engage to being an investor, a contributor to the building of infrastructure, a contributing to the building of industry, and argues that it has no views on domestic politics, which of course again runs contrary to the idea that you have a responsibility to protect. You have no responsibility to protect. You have a responsibility to leave countries on their own and only try to help them economically develop. But we don't really know what will happen on the day that Chinese investments in one of these areas are threatened. I'm sure the Chinese have thought long and hard about it. Anything else would be very surprising. They are strategic. But you know, if Chinese investments in the oil industry in the Sudans are threatened by unrest, where there are perhaps even conceivably direct attacks on Chinese interests, where Chinese are being killed, where Chinese factories or pipelines or whatever are being burnt down, what would be the Chinese response? I have no idea. But the one thing I am certain about is that the Chinese have thought about it. And I'm not so sure that their response there and then will be, we don't do anything that is political or military in any of those countries. So I think that is a bit of perhaps a joker in the room as much as an elephant in the room. I don't think we know. But it's an important question.
Yeah,